Hello, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Daisy Sindelar, a writer at RFURL, and I'll be your host this week as we look back at a day that changed the world as we know it.
We have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into the of the World Trade Center.
There's any kind of an effort up there yet. Now remember, oh my God.
Hunt down and to find those folks who committed this act. Terrorism against our nation will not stand.
It was the stuff of nightmares. On September 11th, 2001, 19 hijackers loyal to the then little-known Al-Qaeda network seized control of four passenger jets. Two were flown into the Twin Towers of New York's World Trade Center, a third dove into the Pentagon outside Washington, D.C., and the fourth crashed in an empty field in Pennsylvania after passengers fought to take control of the plane back from the hijackers. In all, more than 3,000 people from 80 countries were killed on 9/11. The attack prompted the launch of the War on Terror, with continuing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, and ushered in a decade of global uncertainty and fear. To mark the 10-year anniversary, RFE has collected voices from around the world of people sharing their own memories of 9/11. You'll hear some of these today in this podcast. You can also find the reflections gathered on a special Tumblr page linked to our website at rfurl.org. Some are young Americans who were studying abroad, living thousands of miles away from home. Others were professionals living in Midtown Manhattan with friends and family in the towers. Still others were people watching the news unfold at home in their own countries, with no direct connection to the United States or the Twin Towers. Some were horrified, others sympathetic. Some watched with a grim sense that the United States was getting what it deserved. But for nearly everyone watching the events on September 11th, there was one sentiment in common, the feeling that life, as many people knew it, was over. Nowhere was that more true than for family members of people killed on September 11th. Alice Hoagland's 31-year-old son, Mark, was one of the small group of passengers on United Flight 93 to rush the cockpit in an attempt to overpower the hijackers. The plane soon crashed in a field, killing everyone on board. But before that, Mark had had the presence of mind to make one final phone call home.
When Mark called us, his message was not one of fear, or he didn't even particularly want to tell us what they were going to do. But his message to us was that he loved us and he wanted to tell us that in case he didn't see us again. That phone call was a gift, and that's the way I truly feel about it. I'll treasure that. It meant a great deal to us that Mark, in his last moments before he went to battle terrorists, his last thoughts were of his family and how much he loved them.
Barry Zellman's brother Kenneth was an insurance broker, working on the 99th floor of the North Tower of the World Trade Center. He and 357 of his colleagues were killed when the first of the four planes flew into the building, crashing through six entire floors, including the one Kenneth was working on. Barry says the 10-year anniversary has no special significance in his family. For him, it's a daily reality.
There's not a day that doesn't go by that I don't shake my head and say, is this real? You know, my only brother, it was very close to me. I can't think of anything that would have been worse in my life that would have happened, you know, to be honest with you. A lot of times it's something that I question. You know, a lot of speeches are given and comparisons to world events and political speakers use it as a platform. To me, it's about loss of 3,000 lives, and that's all it will ever be on the anniversary. I live 9/11 every day and every morning I wake up and think about it. So it's really not an anniversary to me. I live it on a day-to-day level.
For 9/11 family members, a certain kind of closure came earlier this year when U.S. military forces killed Osama bin Laden, the mastermind of the attacks, in an ambush in Pakistan in May. Allison Crowther said she burst into tears when she heard the news. Her 24-year-old son, Wells, had died in the South Tower after helping dozens of other people to evacuate the building.
It was a huge relief. It wasn't joyful, and if you talk to many 9/11 family members, there's no joy in it. It's just we got the job done that needed to be done for our loved ones and to bring this man to justice. And there are more out there. We know that. He's not the last of this, and he had some very powerful people in cahoots with all of this, and we know they're still out there. We know that. We're not foolish. It's not over. But it was symbolic for us and a huge relief that this evil person was taken out.
Some people say it's what we deserve for sins against God and for crimes in the world. I wouldn't know. I'm just holding the fort. Since that day they wounded New York.
If some see 9/11 as an American tragedy, the consequences of that day have undeniably been global in scope. Devastating al-Qaeda attacks have followed in Bali, Istanbul, London, and Madrid. Airline security officials have several times claimed to have prevented subsequent terrorist plots, said to be on a scale with 9/11. And two countries, Iraq and Afghanistan, have become the ravaged epicenter of an ongoing U.S.-led war on terror. Thousands of soldiers and ordinary civilians have been killed in military operations, air raids, and suicide bombings in the years since the campaigns began. Many Americans see 9/11 as the reason the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. But do Afghans see it the same way? RFE correspondent Charles Recknagel reports on how 9/11 is remembered in the country that has spent a decade living with the consequences of the attacks.
There are many places to take the pulse of Afghanistan. Some of the best are the truck stops, which dot the country's main roads. Here, cargoes are loaded and unloaded, opinions are exchanged, and rumors are spread. What do ordinary Afghans think about 9/11? Ask anyone, like this man, a shopkeeper at a stop along the highway linking Wardak province to Kabul.
I was in Peshawar, Pakistan, when I heard that in America they had attacked skyscrapers. I saw it on television and heard about it on the radio. What can I say? You know what happened next? The world came to Afghanistan because they said that the Taliban and the Islamic Party or Hizb-e-Islami attacked the buildings. But the Muslims don't accept that and think the Americans did it themselves.
The shopkeeper's idea is a common one in Afghanistan. Many people here believe that 9/11 was a pretext for the United States to invade their country. Even now, they say, U.S. forces refrain from destroying the Taliban because the war allows foreigners to continue occupying Afghanistan, although no one, the shopkeeper included, can quite say why. We continue driving, this time to a truck stop in Logar province, directly south of Kabul. All around are laborers who gather here each day in hopes of occasional work. One, John Mohammed, can't remember exactly where he was on 9/11. But one thing he says for certain is that life has gotten worse ever since.
I don't know where I was during this attack because I was working as a laborer in Islamabad, but later I saw it on television. It brought us nothing good. Everything is against us and we have lost a lot. The American and international forces came and as a result we lost a lot of relatives and friends in the war. Every day, dozens of our people die, while international forces have brought nothing good for us, including any work.
What did he expect? Mohammed ticks off a number of things: factories, electricity, water, and security. But with none of these in sight, the present, to him, makes no more sense than the past. Nearly everyone in Afghanistan agrees that 9/11 changed their lives. But does anybody know in detail what happened that day? Does anyone feel like the war here is part of a larger global struggle against terrorism? It takes some looking to find such a person, but finally we meet one. Abdul Rahim, a shopkeeper, at a roadside market north of Kabul in Kapisa province.
My information about 9/11 is that an airplane controlled by al-Qaeda hit a building in America and a lot of people were killed. After that, America and the world felt they should do something to destroy al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups active in the world. They came to Afghanistan to find the root of the problem and remove it.
Abdulrahim is the kind of person the international forces in Afghanistan need to explain their presence if they are to succeed in stabilizing the country. We ask what it is that makes him such a supporter of the new order when so many others are filled with doubt. The reason, he says, are the suicide bombings.
In Kapisa province, we have suicide attacks and we have lost several close friends. We condemn suicide attacks. According to Sharia too, this is wrong. Those who organize them are misusing the young generation and misleading them with evil ideas. The suicide attacks kill innocent people and we hear of them almost every day. Our wish is for the American and other international forces to destroy the bases of these groups. We know there is a high cost, but we support that.
For him, the suicide bombings are the daily echoes of 9/11 and the common link between what happened in New York and Washington 10 years ago and what is happening in Afghanistan today. Not everybody hears the echoes that way, but for those who do, it is a convincing argument for trying to root out terrorism now before foreign forces withdraw and Afghanistan is on its own.
That was Charles Recknagel on how ordinary Afghans view 9/11 and the events that have followed. His story was based on reporting by Syed John Sabawun of RFE's Afghan service. Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday. In many parts of the world, it's hard to find a person who doesn't remember where they were on 9/11. No matter how ordinary your actions that day, they all seem to become infused with a kind of crystalline significance in retrospect. As part of its 9/11 coverage, RFE has collected short essays and video statements from Americans and others about their own 9/11 memories. Let's listen to a few of them now.
I'm from Spain, in Barcelona, and there is a traditional party in the 11th of September, so I was with my friends, and when I heard about the disaster, it was very strange for me, because I really didn't thought something that like that could happen, and I was celebrating another thing. It was strange.
In 2001, I was a reporting assistant working for the Wall Street Journal. Our offices were in the Financial Center on Liberty Street, which was just across from the World Trade Center. On September 11th, I passed through my usual subway stop at the Trade Center and made my way to the Upper East Side, where I was scheduled for a 9 a.m. wedding dress fitting with a highly regarded New York City seamstress. I was getting married the next month. When I arrived at the shop, the radio was on full blast, and my seamstress was distraught, saying that an airplane had flown into one of the Twin Towers and that her brother was inside the building. The shop didn't have a television, and neither did any of the nearby businesses, so I didn't fully comprehend the magnitude of what I figured was a small commuter plane accident. I suppose my Wall Street Journal colleagues downtown were probably riveted to their windows in the financial center watching the little plane being scraped off the top of one of the towers, and the journalist in me was kind of jealous that I was missing the whole thing. As the tragedy unfolded on the radio that we were listening to inside the dress shop, the severity of what was happening became a lot clearer to me. And finally, when Roman Catholic Cardinal Edward Egan, who was, turns out was a very close friend of my seamstress, called the shop to comfort and reassure her and console her, I realized that I needed to get back to the office. When I walked out of the shop, hundreds and thousands of people were streaming uptown, and so I fought my way through the crowds, and I ended up at the CBS building at the southeast corner of Central Park, and hundreds of people were outside CBS watching these massive screens and silently taking in the annihilation of first the South Tower and then the North Tower. When I saw that, I thought that my office was destroyed and my colleagues surely didn't survive. And so I was kind of in a daze, and I made my way to the Wall Street Journal's Midtown office, where miraculously I learned that everybody at the paper had survived. We published a paper the next morning, and in the following spring, our coverage of that day won the Pulitzer Prize. In early October, I had to go back and pick up my wedding dress from my seamstress, and part of me was really dreading the trip because I just didn't want to find out what happened to her brother. And so I walked into the shop, and she was standing there behind the counter, and I just stood there, and I looked at her, and she just looked at me, and she said, "We found him at the hospital. He survived."
I'm from Guildford in Surrey, in England, and on September 11th, I was sat in a pub in Guildford with two friends, and some minutes after the first plane hit the first tower, somebody's phone went off and there was a text message saying that an aeroplane had crashed into the World Trade Center in New York City. And I remember only being vaguely aware of exactly what the World Trade Center was. I knew it was a giant building in New York. I didn't know exactly where or the history of it. And I remember saying, "It must be a terrorist attack. That can't be an accident." We left the pub and we went to the high street where there was an electrical store that sold a lot of TVs, and it was crammed with people. And there were just people standing awestruck with their mouths open watching the TVs, and every single one of them was flashing back these unbelievable images as if we were watching some kind of Bruce Willis movie. And it was at that point where we stood and we saw the second plane hit the second tower, and it was at that point that everybody, that 3,500 miles away, there was this sense of fear in everybody, like that this was happening anywhere in the world.
In September 2001, I was nearing the end of an around-the-world trip, a trip taken without ever getting on an airplane. I boarded a ferry in Le Havre, France, in the early evening. Arrival time in Portsmouth, England, would be about 10 p.m. Crowded and noisy, I found a seat off to myself. When the ferry docked in Portsmouth, I let the other passengers debark. I was too tired to fight a crowd. I had been on the road for 5 months, and after boarding a freighter in Liverpool, I would have a solitary voyage to the east coast of the United States. From there, it would be an easy train ride to my home in Oregon. When I eventually left the ship, it was deserted. I walked through the tunnel leading to passport control and customs. A lone, uniformed Englishman manned the now-abandoned security counter. The official asked the usual questions, how long I intended to stay, what I planned to do. I feel as much at home in England as I do in the U.S., and so I told him my story. The English official smiled at my tale and how my travels had taken me across the Pacific Ocean to Hong Kong and by rail through China, Mongolia, Russia, and Eastern Europe to Turkey. I told how I had ferried to Greece and then to Western Europe and how my travels had taken me through 22 countries and would eventually total over 15,000 miles of travel by rail. He stamped my passport and I started to walk off. All of a sudden, two plainclothes agents materialized out of nowhere to grasp my left and right arm. Two uniformed police relieved me of my bags, and while one was stationed behind me, the other led the way down a passageway to a small room. In the center of the room was a metal table, and my luggage was placed upon it. My passport was surrendered. In over 30 years of travel, I have never been pulled out of a line. The number of times my luggage has been inspected could easily be counted on one hand, and in each and every case, the inspection has been rather cursory in nature. "Have a look," I responded. "I've nothing to hide." "Oh, we're not concerned with your baggage," one of the plainclothes officers stated. "We overheard you talking to the passport control about where you had been. Could you repeat your story?" I had not seen these men lurking about, but that did not immediately register in my mind or cause concern. They were not threatening in any way. and so once again I told my tale. As I did, one of the officials thumbed through my passport as I rattled off country after country. I ended my story with, "And so, here I am in England. I hope I haven't done anything wrong." I waved my hand again in the direction of my luggage, like sitting like exhibit A and B on the metal table. The man who appeared to be in charge apologized for any inconvenience and told me to have a safe trip. He then said, "We're not especially interested in your baggage. You see, we are just interested in where you have been and how it may be related to terrorism." I left and found a bed and breakfast establishment not far from the ferry terminal. As I fell asleep, the official's last words never entered my mind. The fact that these agents appeared out of nowhere, the fact that I had never been pulled out of a custom or passport line before, seemed a moot point. The date was September 10th, 2001, and in New York City, the dawn of the 11th was only a few hours away.
Finally, two essays we weren't able to record. The first comes from an Iranian working as a journalist at a moderate daily in Tehran at the time of the attacks. He writes, "For some in the newsroom, the depth of the tragedy was still not clear. I interviewed an analyst in London. The most important point he made was that the 9/11 attacks would change the path of history. Such a view, so shortly after the attacks, was surprising for us. My interview made the front page with that same headline." Other Iranian newspapers chose their front page headlines based on whether they were aligned with the reformist, moderate, or hardline factions of the Iranian establishment. A government paper cited reformist President Mohammad Khatami as condemning the attack in the name of the Iranian people. One moderate paper ran a headline reading, "The most horrific terrorist disaster in the heart of the world." Hardline papers went with headlines like, "U.S. leaders in hiding," and "America has collapsed." Later that week, during Friday prayers on September 14th, for the first time in 22 years, participants did not chant the usual "Death to America." This was a symbol of how heavily the attacks had influenced public opinion in Iran. And our last essay comes from a Mennonite woman living in Oregon. "I was at home in our Oregon farmhouse, and the kids were getting ready for school. Suddenly, my 13-year-old daughter came flying downstairs, shrieking about planes flying into the World Trade Center and the towers collapsing. Being Mennonite, we didn't have a TV, so we gathered around the radio in stunned silence while our 2-year-old flitted about in an odd contrast to our stillness. I was probably the very last American to see footage of the tragedy. Many from our community visited neighbors to watch the news on TV, but I never did. And in a bizarre twist, I saw my first video footage of the falling towers that December on a trip to Yemen, Bin Laden's ancestral home, to see my sister. We were visiting a Yemeni friend of hers, relaxing on the low cushions in the sitting room and ignoring the all-Arabic TV, when there it was, a tower falling in a cloud of dust. I told my sister this was the first time I'd seen this. She translated that to her friend, and the friend had a look on her face that said, 'I will never understand Americans.'"
Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind. Make my way through this darkness.
Remember, you'll find more 9/11 memories at our website at rferl.org.
Lost track of how far I've gone. How far I've gone, how high I've climbed. On my back's a 60-pound stone. On my shoulder, half mile line.
Many people were so strongly affected by 9/11 and the events that followed that they now see the day as a moment in history in which their lives were irreversibly altered. There was life before 9/11 and life after. But 9/11 is far from the only tragedy to divide lives into befores and afters. For our final segment, we talked to three RFE broadcasters from Bosnia, Iraq, and Chechnya who remember the days that their own lives changed forever.
My name is Gordon Aknežević. I am director of Balkan Service of Radio Free Europe. My own 9/11 is actually May 2nd of 1992. That was beginning of the war in Sarajevo. And that's the day when my kids, two of my kids, left the city. One child stayed behind with me and my husband and we stayed for the end of the siege of Sarajevo. At the time, my daughter was 6 years old, my son was 14, and the other son was 13 years old. So I had a French journalist, a friend, who came in and said that she has a bus tickets for two kids, that she can take two of my three kids out of the city. And I remember it took me and my husband actually a few minutes to decide. The thinking at the time was that we have to get the little one out of the city as soon as possible, because she couldn't understand that she cannot go out of the house. She couldn't understand that she couldn't play. She didn't want to stay inside, indoors, and the shelling of the city already started. And so we decided quickly that the older brother, who was 14 at the time, would accompany her, and the two of them would join my friend on the bus from Sarajevo to Belgrade. At the time, I was thinking, well, it may be for the summer. I was thinking we will be separated for a few months. It took us as a family 5 years to get together again. And separation was hard on everybody. I remember even the smile, the way how my daughter smiled on that day. She was just thinking of it as a fun trip with an older brother, and she absolutely didn't understand what was going on. And I was just thinking, I wonder if the next experiences would take that smile away from her face, you know, whether I will see her smiling again when we meet, and whether we will meet again.
Režim javljaju da imamo na telefonskoj liniji predsjednika predsjedništva Bosne i Hercegovine Alića Begovića.
I was the deputy editor of the newspaper, and it was beyond imagination for me to leave Sarajevo, because the news were so important and we were the only source of news at the time. So we were publishing every day. Never ever in my life I felt that I have to choose between being a journalist and being a mother. And probably that was that one time when it happened. I don't know whether I would do things the same if I had time to think and if I had a chance to think. When you have shelling, when you have your friends being killed, when you have the lack of food and electricity cut and so on, you are making decisions instantly by your instinct. You are deprived of comfort of making plans. There was no plans. It's almost not possible to explain in what way my life and life of my family and life of every person in Bosnia I know of was changed after the war. Through entire war, I used to say to my husband, if we get all our three kids alive out of this, we are winners. We won the war. But unfortunately, it was an ugly war which didn't leave one thing unchanged. The world as you know it disappeared. And the way how this is changing you is probably the worst, because, for example, I remember nights when we would hear shelling but not very close to our place, and we would make conclusion, well, we can go to sleep. So it meant that people were being killed like 2 or 3 kilometers away from us. And then you think of that and you are disgusted with yourself, and you think how horrible human being you are. You go to sleep and people are being killed just on a short distance from you. And you can live with it, and you can sleep with it. So after the war, I remember it took me a lot of time and a lot of efforts to go back to normal, actually, to rejoin human race, you know, and to declare myself that I am again full-fledged human being.
My name is Hashim Ali Mendi, and I am the editor in the Iraq service. Iraq, like the United States, has a lot of dates, bad and good. For Iraq, is maybe the nearest is the 9th of April, which is the day of liberation of Iraq from a dictatorship, Saddam Hussein. At that time, I was the presenter, but I asked my boss to to allow one of my lady colleague to attend me by the news, just to show that it's done by men and women. And I want her to read this news because she is one of the famous presenter, and she was one of the victims of Saddam's regime. She and her family were imprisoned and tortured. And she said, this is the first day I will announce my name, because she afraid to give her name. And I said, that's good. We won't celebrate this. Faria al-Hussein will read the news that Saddam is away forever. So we did it together. And it was great.
صدام حسين ذكرت وكالة رويترز للأنباء أن المخابرات المركزية
الأمريكية.
This day mean a lot for the Iraqis. Maybe few of them not who was closer to the regime or part of the regime. Unfortunately, also some of them who were glad to have this regime away, they are now not so satisfied because the job is still not done. There is no enough security. And the Iraqis now are afraid that everything will be back or worse when the American forces will leave the country. This regime gave us several dates like that, which was negative, very negative, maybe like 9/11. I mentioned this very lucky day that we became free from him because we have another calendar from him, bad. I left Iraq in April, 11th of April 1980, a few months before the first Gulf War. It's difficult. This is not only my situation. We are millions of Iraqis outside. Still, we have millions of Iraqi outside. I miss my homeland. I dream every night of my childhood city from Kirkuk. It was beautiful.
My name is Aslan Dukaev. I'm the director of RFARL's North Caucasus service. The day which I remember as a turning point in my life and the lives of many other people in Chechnya is November the 26th, 1994. On that day, the Russian government sent a tank column to Grozny to crush the government of General Johar Dudayev. And that was the beginning of the hostilities between Russia and Chechnya, which have lasted for the past 16 or 17 years now. I remember Russian tanks entering Grozny and how various bands of Chechen fighters would attack them from their various positions. And I remember this day as a complete massacre of the Russian forces, simply because of the determination of the defenders of Grozny on the one hand and the complete unpreparedness of the Russian forces to fulfill that task.
Показали здесь на площади в танковых боях. Аллаху Акбар!
Аллаху Акбар! At the time, I was a university teacher in Grozny. I was in charge of the English language faculty, and my family lived with me in Grozny. We saw the whole event from beginning to the end. And it was a shocking revelation for us, simply because we could never believe that the government of Russia could do a thing like that. We never thought that they would resort to such brute force to bring Chechnya into the fold. The sight was terrible. Tanks burning, dead bodies lying around, and a lot of young Russian soldiers were captured by Chechens and they were paraded in front of the cameras. All of a sudden, we got mature, as it were. We became grown-ups all of a sudden. the start of the war was no longer something that surprised us when the full-scale, the full-blown war began and the Russians started to bomb our city. All of a sudden, life became almost unbearable in Grozny. It was a turning point in my life, and my life changed from that day completely. I stayed in Grozny for another 3 years, and I saw the horrors of that war with my own eyes. I lost a lot of friends, relatives, and life was never the same again. Grozny was always a provincial place, but it had its own charms, of course. It was one of the biggest cities in the North Caucasus. It had theaters, universities, colleges, it had a cultural life, and it was my birthplace too. I could never swap it for any other place in the world. It was a very green place too. When I look at the pictures of Grozny today, I can't recognize it because it's no longer green, you know. Everything was hastily rebuilt, and in many places they forget to plant trees. I don't recognize Grozny anymore. It's not the place where I was born. Perhaps the happiest memory of my childhood is when I was playing with my best friend, who was actually not a Chechen, but was Korean. That was another aspect of my childhood. I saw these Korean families who were deported by Stalin from the Far East to Chechnya, of all places. And we grew up together and, you know, we played together. And of course, the time which I spent with my parents and my family, the meals we had together on warm, sunny evenings, the stories which my older siblings told me, that was perhaps those fleeting moments which I still remember, which will remain with me perhaps forever. I really think that life is gone. The 10-year-old children today are the war children, and a lot of them saw the fighting, saw death. I think that was a terribly damaging experience. It will take a long time for that normal life to return to Chechnya.
That was RFE broadcasters Gordana Knezhevich, Hashem Alemandi, and Aslan Dukayev remembering the days that changed their lives forever in Bosnia, Iraq, and Chechnya. Thanks to everyone who contributed their voices and memories to this week's episode of The Blender. I'm Daisy Sindelar, and we'll see you next week. Hey, Sadeh.